who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in. It's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theatre at a field kitchen. None survived, they said. This is Alexander. He says he was sheltering in a basement nearby and came to the theatre the morning after the explosion.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theatre. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside. That's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
There is a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theatre as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theatre. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
A new list released by British Daily, The Sunday Times, says there are a record number of billionaires in the UK, with the richest 250 people worth more than half a trillion pounds. Released in the middle of a soaring cost of living crisis, this year's list has new entrants, among them a UK government minister and his wife.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, The Sunday Times rich list. In this country, it says 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working. And obviously, we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than double or triple their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out, suddenly, out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men. At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices, and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Purizep, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden met South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol for summit talks in Seoul Saturday. The conservative Yoon seeks to strengthen the U.S.-South Korea alliance. Biden's remarks perhaps fell short of the strategic nuclear umbrella the hawkish Yoon seeks, while offering some reassurance regarding North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
Today, President Yoon and I committed to strengthening our close engagement and work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Several demonstrations took place throughout the day outside the summit venue. Peace activists worry Yoon's hasty actions to embrace Washington endanger regional peace and security.
Strengthening the U.S.-South Korea alliance will likely cause a backlash from North Korea, China, and Russia, and destabilize the security of South Korea. If we jump on the U.S. strategy too easily, will this really protect the economy and security of South Korea?
Presidents Yoon and Biden also toured a Samsung Electronics factory. Biden plans to launch the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework in Tokyo next week as the U.S. implements the new trade grouping largely aimed at containing China. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is just 10 days into his 5-year term in office. Through this summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, Seoul has now strongly pivoted to a more pro-American foreign policy. The question then is how U.S. adversaries in the region, China and North Korea, will react. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Outrage has spread across the pro-Palestine community this week after British Home Secretary Priti Patel branded the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement racist and anti-Semitic. The controversial comments were issued on Monday at a Conservative Friends of Israel lobby group event.
The BDS movement, everything we have seen around the BDS movement is racist. The anti-Semitic troops, the cartoons, the chants.
Founded in 2005, the BDS movement is a Palestinian-led campaign promoting boycott and economic sanctions against Israel. After a notable rise in popularity and success in recent years, the British establishment has acted to essentially criminalise the practice. In response to Patel's comments, onlookers have pointed out her own policies and praise of Israel's ambassador as blatant hypocrisy.
The hypocrisy of Priti Patel calling anyone or anything racist on one hand, whilst openly gushing for Tzipi Hotovli on the other. I mean, Tzipi is an out-and-out anti-Arab racist. She thinks that Jews and Arabs should have no relationships at all. She also thinks that the Nakba, the expulsion of 700,000 Palestinians at the birth of Israel, she thinks that was a myth. Secondly, Priti Patel herself, her comments against Black Lives Matter, against English footballers who took the knee against in solidarity against racism, and also the laws that she's brought into place, like the Nationality and Borders Act, these comments, these laws, they've further, deeper structuralized racism into British society.
In addition to the anti-BDS remarks, Patel laid bare her so-called unflinching support to Israel. This comes just days after the shock killing of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhila by Israeli regime forces, making it appear that no matter what crimes are being committed, Tel Aviv can rely on unwavering support from the British Home Office. Robert Carter, London.
On Friday, about 2,000 people staged a rally in the Italian capital calling on the Mario Draghi government and the EU to stop sending weapons to Kyiv and finally promote peace talks to resolve the war in Ukraine. The initiative had been called by a number of base unions and supported by a string of leftist movements. People at the rally expressed high concern over the serious military escalation by all parties involved in the Ukraine conflict.
The EU is not acting right. Its wary posture has only put one bloc against another. The people are those who will suffer from our rulers' decisions in the end.
There are too many conflicting interests at stake, and Italy is far too servile. The EU should do more. I don't support Putin, but I'm also against Zelensky. He is not acting in the interests of the Ukrainians.
Following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, Italy has opted to gradually cut its gas reliance on Russia. Rome has been importing gas from Moscow for over 50 years, and about 45% of its total demand is provided by Russia.
I'm a small retailer. I was forced to close down during the COVID, but I haven't seen a cent of support from the government. And now they spend billions for the war. When will they look after us?
Undoubtedly, the Italian government is far too aligned with NATO, but it's not just that. The government is very much distant from the people, as surveys show the majority of the Italians are against the war.
Since the start of the conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown half of the Italians oppose the sending of weapons to Ukraine and believe sanctions against Russia are useless. About one-fifth of the surveyed Italians have so far said they are in support of the Draghi government's delivery of heavy weapons to Kyiv. The conflict in Ukraine, its dire consequences and the fear it could spread or go on for a long time are not the only worries Italians are concerned with. Rising inflation, the growing cost of energy, blocked salaries, continual crumbling of purchasing power, all economic indicators are pointing towards a recession. Many expect the country to be faced with a hot autumn of strikes and protests. Max Civili, Rome.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been hit with a series of disruptive direct action protests in retaliation to recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Palestine Action have intensified their long-running campaign against Elbit Systems, with activists trashing sites in London and Bristol.
Elbit Systems is a notorious Israeli arms manufacturer with locations dotted all across the UK. Their HQ, located just behind me, is a popular target for Palestine Action, who claim that their activities is focused on disrupting their production activities. Elbit is known for producing up to 85% of Israel's drone fleet, after all.
Israeli crimes against Palestinians has circulated world headlines in recent weeks, particularly surrounding the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akhila, shot dead by Israeli regime forces as she documented an Israeli assault on a Palestinian refugee camp on the 11th of May. The killing occurred just days before the Nakba, an annual date which marks the ethnic cleansing of native Palestinians from their homeland. Elbit's recent response stated,
Elbit Systems UK is proud to provide advanced support for the UK armed forces. Attempting to disrupt this work during a time of heightened global instability is dangerous and highly irresponsible.
However, speaking to Press TV, the activists rubbish Elbit's stance.
How many lives have they saved compared to how many lives they've taken, would be my question. They are responsible for so many deaths of men, women and children. How could you possibly think that that's in any way security? It's illegal, it's a crime. All of these things are criminal, and yet it's when you're out there doing something that you're shown as the criminal, essentially. And I've always found that very interesting as a narrative.
With Palestine action vowing to continue and Israel's occupation persisting, many expect to see more spilling of red paint, but also more Palestinian blood too. Robert Carter, London.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we spoke about the events which led to Imam Khomeini's arrest in 1963 by the notorious organization SAVAK. As you know, we try to quote from Imam Khomeini's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, who was truly a fellow combatant beside the Imam. This time, you will hear on the events after the Imam's arrest, particularly the historical uprising of June 5th, 1963. Stay with us, please.
Thank you.
The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest was like a big blast in the country, as the people of Qom, Tehran, and other cities poured to the streets to protest against the Pahlavi regime's move. The demonstrators chanted slogans like "Death to the Shah" and "Either Death or Khomeini." In the holy city of Qom, people swarmed around the imam's house and chanted anti-regime slogans. The tyrannical regime, in order to intimidate the people, flew military planes over the city, but angry people became more persistent in their move and called for unconditional release of their great leader and source of emulation. The agents of the Shah, scared of the spread of anti-regime sentiments, opened fire and massacred hundreds of people. The news of Imam Khomeini's arrest caused people from all walks of life to demonstrate across the city. University students closed their classes and poured to the campuses in protest. Owners of different occupations in bazaar closed their shops and poured to the streets. Students spread their rallies to the streets and joined the people, demanding the imam's immediate liberation. The regime, security, and police forces tried to control the city by cannons and tanks. In Tehran, too, hundreds of people were massacred by the bullets of the mercenaries of the Shah. In the evening of June 5, 1963, Tehran was plunged in silence. Trucks were gathering the bodies of martyrs to take them to cemeteries. The whole city was full of soldiers to suppress any protest. The people in the small city of Pishva near Varamin in southeast of Tehran created a great epic as they heard the news of Imam Khomeini's arrest. These people, most of whom were farmers, started marching over 20 kilometers toward Tehran while they were wearing their shrouds as a sign of preparedness for death. They chanted slogans like, "Khomeini, Khomeini, you are the son of Hussein. Either death or Khomeini," and "Death to the Shah." Moreover, the people of regional villages joined the marchers and shaped great masses in Varamin. Thus, the people of Varamin also joined the demonstration marching toward Tehran. Almost at sunset, they faced the military squads of the tyrannical regime, Bagherabad village. Seeing the stiff resistance of the people, the military forces cruelly massacred thousands of innocent people and injured thousands of others. People in Qom had gathered around the imam's house. The imam's venerated wife, Lady Khadija Saghafi, relates, "The sound of either death or Khomeini and Khomeini, Khomeini, may God guard you, may your bloodthirsty enemy be dead," had filled our home. The sound came from the street, but it seemed to come from behind the door. Our home was the venue of ladies. They would come and faint. I would put their heads in my lap and restore their health with water and juice. They were the wives of the poor seminary students and classes who really loved the imam. Imam Khomeini's wife, referring to the taunting of a few women affiliated to the regime, continues, "But at the same time, some women would come and break our hearts with pungent remarks, yet we had decided to keep calm." Comparing the women who would faint with those who would taunt us was the comparison of poverty and courage with richness and compromise. Imam Khomeini's wife points to the horrible atmosphere of Qom and the regime's flying of military planes over the city on June 5th, saying, "On June 5th, the regime had ordered phantom planes to fly over Qom to intimidate people. Women and men in Qom had become scared of breaking the sonic wall in the city. It seemed that the planes would fly low when they reached our house. They would maneuver with queer speed over the city, and this would deteriorate the condition of most women in our house. So I and my daughters would give them juice. They had come to soothe us, but it was we who were soothing them." Lady Saqafi continues on the self-sacrifice and resistance of people in those days. "People went on a stiff strike and closed all shops for 15 days. At last, the government forced the people to open their jobs and shops through intimidation and burning some shops and demolishing big stores. Of course, upon my elder son, Mustafa's opinion and permission, bakeries and butcheries opened for a few hours in the first days to meet people's needs. Fruits had gone bad in shops, but nobody would open. Honestly, people showed high self-sacrifice and resistance." She continues, "Near the sunset, there was a rumor of attacking our house at night to captivate women. This rumor made men think over replacing us. Mr. Ishraqi and Mustafa asked for replacement. I told them, 'Are you scared?' They said, 'We have heard so.' I said, 'It is false. I won't leave this house. I am ready for captivity, but not escape.' I resisted, but Mustafa was anxious and angry. So I accepted unwillingly. We went to Mr. Ishraqi's house. God knows how it was hard for me, but I tolerated. We went and came back the day after to see that I was right."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has visited Oman. Not only does this trip build upon the brotherly ties that exist between the two countries, they discuss regional issues. Iran's President has said that regional countries should solve their problems and that foreign powers should not interfere and leave the region altogether. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the relationship between these two countries and look at the role that Iran plays when it comes to other countries in the region, including problem areas like Palestine and the presence of foreign forces. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Expert in West Asian Affairs, Kevin Barrett, joins us from Madison. Also joining us is journalist and political analyst, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, who joins us from Islamabad.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines.
featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Kevin Barrett, and ask you about the visit by Iran's president to Amman. It was pretty wide in terms of the MOUs that were signed, 12 agreements, cooperation agreements from what we understand. So in terms of trade, it was obviously very fruitful. And prior to that, they revived a gas pipeline that was in the works for quite some time. How do you see this relationship in terms of its significance, especially for the region altogether?
Well, this is a very good move for Iran, Oman, and the whole region. The 12 cooperation agreements cover all kinds of ground. And as you suggested, one of the most important, probably the most important, is that gas pipeline issue. That's been in the works for well over a decade. And, of course, the Western powers, well, that's a euphemism, really, for the United States, which is largely under Israeli control when it comes to U.S. Mideast policy, has been blocking it and trying to find ways to make sure it doesn't happen. And now it may be that the Americans are of two minds. On the one hand, of course, they're still brutally sanctioning Iran. They're being completely unreasonable in their JCPOA negotiations. And they're obviously still under the thumb of the Zionists. But on the other hand, they have a huge problem on their hands in Ukraine, where, contrary to what the Western media tells us, Russia is achieving its objectives in this special military operation. And at this point, with energy prices soaring and Europe trying to find a way to live without Russian gas and oil, but gas being the biggest problem, and the U.S. Desperately trying to make sure the Europeans stay on this course of boycotting Russia and substituting liquid gas, the propane variety, for the gas they've been importing from Russia through pipelines from Russia. There's a huge market right now for this liquid gas that can be shipped overseas. And apparently Oman wants to manufacture that. And Iran has one of the largest, possibly about the largest, or tied for number one in terms of all gas reserves. So it may be a propitious time for this. And it may be a time for Iran to break out of its isolation, or it's not really isolated, of course. Iran is trading with most of the world, including the biggest countries like China, as well as Russia and many others. But it's been hammered by the West and the United States at the direction of the Zionists. But this may be a time to change that. And by breaking out and becoming a savvy player in regional diplomacy, building on this relationship with Oman, we could see a sea change in the region as other regional powers understand that the future of the region is in independence and autonomy and freedom from Zionism and imperialism.
Well, let's take a look at some of the stances taken. And one of the most important ones that came out of this meeting, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, is what Raisi noted about dialogue and cooperation, where he said the remarkable key point is that dialogue and cooperation among the regional countries would create security, but the presence of foreign forces would not by any means, and could even threaten regional security. First of all, what do you think about that, and isn't that a direct reference to the U.S.?
It is absolutely a direct reference to the U.S. I think Iran has long held that the West Asia region, or the region surrounding Iran, must become much more autonomous, independent, and not reliant on the United States as the local policeman, which is exactly what the Arab world has largely facilitated. I mean, they've cooperated and collaborated in their own, if you like, their own subordination. And let's not forget that Donald Trump, for all his ills, he said it very, very plainly. He said, we're here to milk the cow. And he was referring to Saudi Arabia. But of course, that extends to Kuwait, extends to the United Arab Emirates, and all the Gulf region, really. And that's exactly what the Americans have been doing and continue to do. And of course, Israel gets its benefits from that American boots on the ground, will support you militarily and strategically. What Iran is saying is that, look, we're here to stay. America's going to eventually leave. They don't belong in this region. They belong in the Americas. But when the oil runs out, when your gas runs out, when they no longer want to milk you as cows, what are they going to do then? Who are you going to turn to? So the reality is that the Arab nations need to think very, very deeply about their longer-term interests. And I think Iran has continually offered them a very reasonable alternative, and that is, first of all, I think, in trying to, even in President Rouhani's era, where he launched the Hope Initiative in the 74th session in the UN General Assembly. That Hormuz peace endeavor floundered with a counter, if you like, measure by the Americans and the Israelis to open up relations with the UAE and to sort of open up more relations with Bahrain, et cetera, the Moroccans too. But of course, this visit of Amir Abdullahian to Oman and meeting Sultan Haitham bin Tariq is a positive indicator from the Iranian policy perspective, in the sense that upgrading those cultural and political reactions or those relations, rather, to higher levels of economic and business cooperation kind of set the pattern and a trend. And it's not an isolated trend, because Iran's Customs Administration spokesman, Ruhollah Latifi, said very recently that Iran's trade exchanges with its neighbors from March to December 2021 were valued at 92 million tons in volume and more than $46.2 billion in cash. And that constituted basically an increase of 13% in volume and 28% in monetary value from the year prior. Now, that also added to that is that Oman has had a 40% increase in its bilateral trade with Iran during the past year as well. So you can see that Iran is making inroads into creating not only that sense that there should be an independent West Asia, which really relies on its own economic power for itself, rather than being milked like a cow, as it has been done for maybe six or seven decades or more.
Sure. It's interesting, Kevin Barrett, our guest there, mentioned the Hope Initiative that was actually presented by the Iranian former Iranian President Rouhani at the UNGA. And just made me think about one of the failed initiatives that the U.S. At one point had proposed years ago, and that was a what we call West Asia, this region, the West Asian Arab NATO. Remember that? How it flopped? It didn't even take off. However, this initiative that Sayyid Mohsen Abbas talks about is something that actually Oman has taken the lead now on, that insisting on continuing the cooperation with Iran to provide maritime security and to counter maritime terrorism in the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and the Strait of Hormuz. So in that light, Oman has taken the lead, and that is very significant, isn't it?
Indeed, yes. This kind of security cooperation with Iran will ultimately be in the interests of other countries in the region as well. These countries currently are experiencing, you know, the difficulties of being essentially, if not exactly colonized, but certainly client states of a declining empire. And as the U.S. empire continues to decline, this whole notion of an Arab NATO and global NATO and so on will seem more and more absurd, because obviously what NATO really is it's a euphemism for the U.S. military occupation of Europe, which began after World War II and never ended. And the rest of the world doesn't particularly want to be occupied by a single unipolar hegemonic empire. There are better ways to ensure global and regional security that can also preserve the autonomy and independence and sovereignty of the nations involved. And of course, that is what Russia says it's ultimately fighting NATO about. And it's also what China, the rising number two power, espouses. And given the economic changes in the world, as the West's share of global GDP declines precipitously, clearly the future is in these kind of independent regional security arrangements between sovereign nations in a multipolar world, rather than everybody signing up for some super NATO and being occupied by the U.S. military in a unipolar world. That's a pipe dream. It's never going to happen.
Looking at the respective countries, which we will take a look at that, say, Mohsen Abbas, one thing that just stands out preventing security and stability to be established in the region, no matter practically wherever you look at, is Israel. Whether you look at Syria, whether you look at, for example, Iraq in terms of Erbil, and, of course, with the way that the occupation is being exercised, with the rights of Palestinians being violated on a daily basis. Putting that next to the normalization of some of these Arab countries, isn't that the, one of the biggest challenges, if not the biggest, to make sure this region is free from outside interference? And, of course, Israel is being steered by the U.S. in some respects.
If Israel wasn't in West Asia, there would be peace throughout the region. I have absolutely no doubt about that. The fact that the Americans are there is primarily because they have this kind of bizarre commitment to an illegitimate state, which is essentially committed to expansionism through its Yinon plan, through its peripheral, so-called expansion policy as well. These are all givens that the American Congress seems absolutely incapable and, deterred in terms of trying to change policy-wise. The fact is that big Zionist capitalist corporate mafias control the bulk of American politics, and unfortunately, that is what dictates the situation in the Middle East as it is today. Now, Israel will not stop its expansionism. It's currently more paranoid than it's ever been before, predominantly because the Islamic Republic of Iran has stood tall and has managed to assemble a resistance axis, which is saying no to the oppression of all the oppressed in that region, and particularly the Palestinians. So until Israel can first of all really negotiate its own self-annihilation, essentially, there will be no peace in that region, because what they're doing is buying up these other proxy states like Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain, and then they are pushing forward illogical, irrational foreign policies, largely which are aimed at securing the interests of Israel, not the interests of Saudi Arabia or the interests of the Bahrainis, etc. So, for instance, the war of the Saudis in Yemen does no justice to them. There's no need for them to have that war. They're so wealthy, they hardly need Yemen to become any wealthier. The war, for instance, in Syria, which the Saudis and the Gulf nations engaged in, was another war that they financed on the say-so of CENTCOM and the Israeli sort of military establishment and the big boys who want to dictate the affairs in the region. So everything is wrong about Israel being in the Middle East, just simply from the point of view of peace, prosperity, and, if you like, stability. The Islamic Republic of Iran, by contrast, has not invaded any of these countries,
right?
Not for 200 years, as have the Iranians stepped outside of their own territories. They've been largely rather invaded. So the same Israeli and American forces imposed an eight-year war on Iran, killed over a million, soldiers or citizens one way or another of that region. Since then, they haven't stopped. Iraq, Syria, up even as far as Libya, if you want to count Afghanistan, these are all bordering, mainly sure. They are bordering countries to Iran. And so, of course, that mass chaos and that warfare is what Iran is trying to avert for the future with its policies in the region now.
So, but you have to put this into context for us in terms of how this works out when you have, for example, the UAE, Kevin Barrett, courting Syria, just one of the countries, which indicates obviously there's a shift underway when it comes to Syria, along with Jordan, who has done the same, and Bahrain. In the meantime, these are countries that have a relationship or have formalized the relationship, which, by the way, did exist before, but they just came out and formalized it to the world with Israel. So how does that work out? I mean, when you have them reinstating Syria into the fold, so to speak, but yet at the same time have this relationship with Israel.
Well, they're trying to play both sides, and that's understandable because we're in a period of shift. The geopolitics of the region and of the world is moving fairly rapidly, perhaps increasingly so, towards this end of the unipolar American imperial era. And in the West Asian region, I agree completely with the other guest that there would be peace and prosperity absent this illegitimate Zionist entity, which is the root cause of the worst conflicts. And you know, we see how its lawlessness with the assassination of Colonel Hassan Syed Khodei the other day on Sunday, and then a couple of weeks ago, the murder of the American journalist Shireen Abu Akhla. These are just, you know, two recent examples of this kind of ridiculously lawless, psychopathic behavior from the Zionist entity. So why would these countries like the Emirates and some others that are moving towards a more rational and balanced regional policy and openly recognizing Syria, perhaps against the orders of their usual masters in Washington, why would they be moving towards friendship with the Zionist entity? Again, I think that they are kind of trying to bet on both sides or situate themselves in such a way that they can draw some sort of profit to themselves and political advantages from their seemingly friendly relations with the Zionists. But we have to remember that the change in the region is towards more independence from the imperial powers and the Zionists who run and own them. And so I think that these people who are betting on profiting from a short period of friendship with the Zionists are also seeing that in the long term, the Zionist entity is likely to go the way of the dinosaurs, and that's why they are simultaneously open to these kinds of regional peace initiatives like we're seeing with Iran and Oman.
And it's very interesting in terms of Syria. We have some more hot spots that we need to talk about, but can't leave this one alone yet, say Mohsen Abbas. And that is the fact that you have what happened days ago for the first time with the Russian S-300 missile defense system actually fired shots for the first time, enacted by Russia, towards those fighter jets that had bombed Syria. And there were speculations at this point that that is because of the fact that Israel has supported Ukraine in the special military operation that Russia has done. Can you explain to us how Russia fits now into the picture when it comes to Israel? Because Syria remains a country that Israel just continues to bomb, which it did again just a couple of days ago.
Well, this has been a bit of a thorny issue. But the Russians, quite clearly, whilst they came to Syria and supported the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hezbollah, and the Syrian government in, if you like, averting the collapse of Syria, essentially, and the occupation of Syria by Zio-American forces, they at the same time have been playing a balancing game. They have had amicable relations with Israel. The Russians have many citizens that actually go and live in Israel itself. There are clear indications that the Israeli establishment goes to and fro and has largely garnered the neutrality, at least, of Russia in affairs. And in fact, there was also talk of Russia agreeing that they wouldn't use these S-300s. In fact, they wouldn't do anything to prevent Israeli warplanes dominating Syrian airspace. There seemed to be an informal agreement between all the powers as to who dominated which part of the aerial sectors. Now, one Russian plane was actually shot down accidentally, it seems, or the Israelis played a certain game in which they shadowed in such a way that the Russians weren't able to save one of their aircraft, and actually several Russians died. That didn't trigger any kind of major response from the Russians. They certainly obviously raised concerns. But what's happening now in Ukraine, it seems as though, again, where Ukraine has a large support from Israel, it also has a lot of Ukrainians who are in Israel as well. It seems as though Israel has been torn between keeping that neutrality with Russia and going in and supporting the American and NATO aggressions, essentially, in Ukraine. That's been a choice that it hasn't been able to avoid. And it seems as though some of the exchanges between Foreign Minister Lavrov and the Israelis have got very, very deep. And perhaps this could see the signal, well, it could signal the Russians taking a more hard line on Israel in West Asia as well, and particularly in Syria. That remains to be seen.
Sure. And what remains to be seen, but it seems to be on a positive track, and this could change the not only the equation on the ground, but also it's almost like a tectonic shift that's going to happen. And that is the way that Iran and Saudi Arabia have had some degree of rapprochement with each other. They are talking to each other. There has been some progress, but it's not there yet. At the same time, Saudi Arabia, it doesn't even have a channel of communication open with the U.S. President, Joe Biden. It doesn't even talk to Joe Biden, the Saudi Crown Prince, including the UAE. So if that remains that way and Iran and Saudi Arabia continue and open up embassies, for example, does that mean then that could be the final straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of the U.S. not having really the solid footing in the region any longer?
Yes, I think it would be. I think that the Saudis have played the key role in maintaining U.S. dominance of the region, and they are the swing oil producer globally. And so their importance, despite the fact that their rulers have not always been particularly competent or exemplary, they have played an outsized role in the world. And now that suddenly we see them moving out of the American orbit, as indeed the Saudi king had threatened to do in the summer of 2001, just a month before 9/11, he said that the writing is on the wall. He said it's time for, quote, the parting of the ways. And in fact, it was only the false flag operation of 9/11 that allowed the Americans and their Zionist masters to reel Saudi Arabia back into the American orbit. We could see something like that again. And if so, it will be good for the region and for the world.
Now, I'm sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Kevin Barrett, expert in West Asian affairs from Madison. Saymusin Abbas, a pleasure, from Islamabad, journalist and political analyst. Thank you. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitapoy and the team. It's goodbye until next time.